Today we welcome Nadeem Chowdhury. Nadeem, you are the founder of the World Hajj and Leaders, and you just had a big congress in Amsterdam. And first of all, welcome from John and I. But just tell us a little bit about yourself, perhaps for the listeners, and a little bit perhaps about the congress that you've just organised in Amsterdam.
Hi, Dari. Thanks a lot for having me on, and hi to John too. World Hajj and Leaders was started sort of towards the end of 2019 and properly got going as a reaction really to the pandemic. So we, Green Power Global, have been doing renewable energy events and focusing on climate change since 2003. So in that time, we've run, I think, 450 different events, was looking at how to accelerate markets specifically to combat climate change. So back in the day when we first started, I was focusing really at sort of carbon markets. The idea then of having renewable energy being able to compete at parity with fossil fuels was a sort of long off vision, I guess. So very much thought the immediate area to focus on was to get the polluters to pay, so to have functioning global carbon markets was the holy grail, and we came off some of the backgrounds of the Kyoto Protocol. So there was a couple of mechanisms, the Clean Development Mechanism, and various other things that fed into the first European carbon market emission trading scheme. So we focused on events specifically, on conferences and bringing people together, and then launched training with John Massey in 2007, again looking at what we could do to help accelerate change by making sure people could make informed decisions and understand the markets and where to do business. So there's been a lot of different markets we've covered over that time. We were in biofuels, and we built a big congress there called World Biomarkets, which also was an area of great divisiveness around, the sustainability of biofuels, the unintended law of unintended consequences. So yeah, that's what we've been doing, and bringing it right up to speed with World Hydrogen Leaders. We'd had World Hydrogen Congress in production, and we're looking at it since 2018. So we had to repurpose some of our research, and we've obviously built with yourself as well, some training courses and other areas that we began to deliver online. And we thought we'd house all of those training courses together under one roof, as it were. So World Hydrogen Leaders was born. So we developed, again, a platform for a community where people could exchange and connect, really, so that we could help connect the value chain. And also have a sort of central repository where people could get trained and get up to speed with all of the latest science and technology. And then also a whole series of online conferences where people could engage on different parts of the value chain, but also on different markets as well. So coming right back up to speed, so last month, October, we were able to finally deliver a physical version of World Hydrogen Congress, which went very well. So we had 1,000 people in Amsterdam, we had some good feedback. We had a lot of people that were obviously really thirsty to meet people, and it really sort of showed the value of actually meeting people face to face and exchanging ideas and connections. It was great. And now I'm on my way to Dubai. I'm just on my way. So you're gone.
A few things struck me in your remarks there. You mentioned a couple of things. One was, of course, the pandemic, which has cut across much interaction for the last 18 months. And then the vibrancy of the conference itself. I think the timing was really auspicious. And I think obviously the content matter, and of course people really meeting face to face again, there's nothing like it, led to a very, very upbeat kind of backdrop to it. And I think with 1,000 people, I mean, I can only imagine the amount of effort and the amount of risk involved in setting an event event up of that magnitude, with all the chops and changes to various policies, which were, I'm sure, affecting all of the delegates from around Europe and beyond for it.
It was definitely a roll of the dice, not one that I recommend for those of weak heart. But we were able to sort of get it off and safely, and everyone was vaccinated and there was huge uncertainty. Two, three weeks out, there was still a quarantine for people coming in from the UK and the US. So fairly significant impacts. But luckily, Europe and the amount of market activity that's happening in Europe itself, the event could pretty much stand on its own legs, just really catering to what's happening in Europe. We did obviously have international travelers or inter-regional travelers. We had a good group from coming out from Latin America. We had Mexicans, Brazilians, Chileans. We were quite pleased, and a decent amount of Americans as well. Hopefully 2022 we'll see a return to normality, because we're obviously discussions ongoing in Glasgow, but we all know we're running out of time, and there's a huge, huge, ridiculous slope to climb in front of us. Having been involved for maybe the last 20 years in decarbonisation, but really just the last 10 years in electricity. And it was really when we began looking outside of electricity in sort of 2018 and picking back up on some of the sustainable gas work. So we used to do some stuff on biogas, and in biogas, we were looking at researching into hydrogen. And we just began to see the sheer extent of what needs to happen for the molecule market, for replacing methane and oil, and particularly heavy oil. So clearly, I think we quite easily decarbonize light vehicle segments with electricity, but there are going to be challenges, I think, in the path to electricity. I'm speaking to you today from Pakistan. I'm visiting my father before I go to an event in Dubai, and just having struggles with electricity grids out here, and just seeing what, if they need to decarbonize their transport fleet, looking at the statistics and thinking about, where is the growth of emissions going to come from? And it's all the fast growing countries. I can see huge challenges involved in rolling out electricity grids and trying to have one grid that's providing, everything, in terms of heating, cooling, mobility and power
if I could refer you back to that original vision you mentioned, which I think might have even come from Mrs. Thatcher, the polluter pays, and how that has been something of a leitmotif throughout your career. Thinking about how the discussions in Amsterdam, obviously you've just highlighted the challenges, but there also seems to be an appetite to face those challenges, and perhaps it won't be just one grid, perhaps there'll be two or three, and perhaps converting the electron to a molecule, which people were talking about a lot, could offer that transition. So if you think, it's hard when you're in the day-to-day in this industry, you think nothing's moving, but if you were to take a bigger picture, you could say actually there's some seismic movements. People who you would have thought would never be committing to net zero have gone on the record and made dramatic statements.
I think it is seismic. I think, there is a huge way to go, but I think if you think back, in 2007 we were nowhere. We had I can 2007 was the first time we ran a solar event. I remember it quite vividly, speaking to some people on the sidelines from the finance community, and these are energy guys, and as in fossil fuel financiers, because then that was the majority of finances that were there. Solar was a joke. Solar was a toy. It was never going to take a sizable part of the energy mix, the electricity mix, even then. And Michael Liebrich had started then. I remember him and the New Energy Finance team and the Bloomberg Energy Finance team, the first time seeing the ideas of cost curves being extrapolated into the energy industry and seeing, and that was, I think, the original concept behind Hermann Scheer, who drove through the feed-in tariffs into the German Bundestag, and it was his oratory, his character, his forceful personality that got that through, and his vision was very much around, we will get I can't remember the first program, it was 100,000 roofs, 1 million roofs in Germany. you know, we get to that, then the costs will come down. And yeah, and he was right, and that's what's happened. But I remember those conversations, and yeah, no one really believed it that much. So, but yeah, we've seen what happens. I don't know why we didn't believe it so much, because obviously it's happened successively throughout history through virtually all technologies. But yeah, it certainly allowed us to get to the state where people are able to put down and make big statements, albeit big statements. I would say that slightly nuanced, because there's a lot of like 2050s and 2060s, and I think India's is 2070, which is which is fine, and it's great. It does obviously show you the direction of travel, but what we really need is some strong 2030 targets. But yeah, clearly technology has allowed us to do that, because it's allowed, you know, it's going to be happening anyway, because it's economically sensible to have, you know, 80% plus renewable energy grid powering, ever increasing amount of applications, chiefly amongst those would be mobility. But yeah, clearly.
And if I was to ask you to sum up obviously you had the financiers, supply chain, project developers, the whole panoply of those delivering this in Amsterdam a few weeks ago. If I was to ask you to sum up, or to ask you for the key takeaways, you mentioned the optimism. Was that reflected? Was that reflected in deliverables, if you like, rather than some vague 50 years ambition? Does that translate to projects on the ground, projects in the next 7 or 8 years that you referred to just now?
There is certainly, I think the biggest reflection for me was that the sheer scale of different initiatives happening globally. So you've got some of the big mega projects, and talking to some of the people from the Middle East, and Dan Feldman from Shearman and Sterling, who is the sort of lead energy lawyer on that project. The NEOM project is a 4 gigawatt solar and wind plant linked to the largest, you know, ammonia plant, linked to the largest hydrogen plant, you know, massive, massive scale plant. It's a $500 billion project in Saudi Arabia to build this huge sustainable city, and the NEOM project that, you know, it's going to be producing obviously green ammonia and hydrogen as part of that. Those huge projects, and you know, they are happening. You know, there's steel going in the ground, and it will happen. And those drivers, and you know, those Middle Eastern countries, and I'm going to Dubai next week, and you know, their future, they see, okay, yeah, they're clearly going to be looking at the blue hydrogen route, but equally they are well blessed with clearly solar resources, and equally, you know, good wind resources in certain regions. The NEOM project, I think, is the size of Belgium, and it's got strong wind and solar, and you get obviously optimize your electrolyzer, and you can be creating cheap hydrogen. And then obviously it's big arguments that are still raging about the usage case for hydrogen, but if it can be produced cheaply, then yeah, it stands a chance of competing. And at that, yeah, but obviously there are massive challenges right across the value chain. But maybe backpedaling a bit, aside from those mega projects, you're seeing other smaller projects, be them in smaller islands. You're seeing, talking to Engie about decarbonizing, you know, mining trucks in South Africa with Anglo America. Yeah, and these mining trucks consume 6,000 liters of biodiesel a day, and yeah, it's obviously a niche, but you can begin to start seeing lots of niches. You know, there's currently a big niche in hydrogen forklift trucks, whether they will survive increasing innovation in battery forklift trucks, who knows? But there is, you know, an existing niche there, so you can begin to see lots of these niches, and then clearly some of the niches become quite big when you start talking about maritime shipping, and you start talking about e-fuels for aviation and even direct power using liquid hydrogen for aviation. So yeah, there is a whole array of, I guess, innovation to happen in hydrogen, which is why I think it makes it interesting, and why I think it is definitely worth pursuing, because we, you know, can't get to net zero without hydrogen. It's the question mark is on the extent of hydrogen. And I think that is a question that will be answered through innovation ultimately. Electricity is in a very strong position to take increasing chunks of the mobility and the heat market. But equally, there are going to be certain applications which will potentially be more cost effective covered via clean hydrogen.
About your career, Nadeem, and how things have changed. I was many years at Shell too, and you talked about some of the early years, and then perhaps with the both wind and solar perhaps being boutique products. I started back in wind about 2005, and it really was, we thought it was big at the time, with 60 meter to tips. And now we've found that people like, they were at the conference, weren't they, Shell and Total and other big oil. And to such an extent that you talked about NEOM there, but let's not forget that this is hosted in the home of oil and gas. This is in Saudi Arabia. Who would have thought in 2007 that Saudi Arabia would be announcing mega projects based around renewable energy? So I know it's difficult when you're within it, but sometimes when you take a step back and say, well, actually, this is almost epoch. It's remarkable. The speed of progress from boutique or niche with people thinking that it was a small part of the bigger picture to now offering significant backing with and going public with it with mega projects. It's a remarkable transformation.
Yeah, it is. And again, I think, you know, we would have never seen any movement at Paris had there not been movement on the renewables front, had there not been, these technology advancements. So, you know, you think back to the arc of time and certain incidences, such as wind and Vestas in Denmark and solar in of all places, Germany, being the birthplace of the sort of solar revolution is somewhat ironic. But there you go. I mean, it is what's happened. And hopefully through the wing and a prayer, we can really start making some sizable inroads into the emissions profiles of various different industries over the coming decade. And I mean, there's no reason why we can't. I mean, yes, quadrupling of sort of renewables deployment just I think within the electricity sector, and then looking at what else can be done beyond if we're talking green hydrogen, there's just so much that needs to happen. But I think there's certainly the will there, and if you look across beyond the actual energy sector and think of the consumption and the, you know, the steel industry, they need green steel. They see, you know, increasing use of wood and different designs where steel isn't there because it's inherently embedded with carbon, and architects will find other solutions. Likewise, you know, cement, likewise, a number of industries, they don't want to follow the fossil fuel industry into becoming a sunset industry. And I think, It's going to be very interesting times. And I think the analogy around innovation and the speed of change, I think, is also apt. You know, we can change quickly, and we can, I think, specifically around, you know, energy efficiency and being able to eat into carbon that way with AI, with some of this increasing intelligence, which is, you know, coming ever towards the edge, and distributed AI and running grids much, much more effectively. So I think that there is a number of different technology platforms that are evolving at the same time. You know, obviously robotics is one of those. We're seeing, you know, essentially Tesla cars are robots. You know, they have. You know, the ability to self-drive, they're certainly going to develop that functionality. That whole business model could see, you know, a massive reduction in the amount of vehicles we need for human mobility. Therefore, we don't need to create so many emissions because you're not all buying cars that sit there for 94% of the time with all of that embedded carbon in a highly complex 14,000 component, you know, massive machine, which is what people's major expenses after they bought houses. So there are certain changes that can happen in the economy that that, that, that can help us keep us on a path towards hopefully, you know, 1.5 degrees. You know, I think, clearly it's going to be tough to keep to that. But on the other side of the coin, we know what's coming in terms of embedded climate change and what's going to hit us. All of the stuff this summer to 2021 was off the charts from any of the climate models. And the report that came out this August is 2 years old. It's 2 years old because it's 1 year delayed by COVID and 1 year because of a peer review process. But, you shouldn't be beating, world temperature records, or sorry, temperature records in northern Canada by 4.6 degrees. Yeah, it should be being beaten by 0.1, 0.2 degrees. So there's massive, massive risk in terms of the system and, feedback loops and runaway sort of impacts. But the costs are just are staggering of not doing anything. And, wildfires on the scale of the islands in Greece, and floods in the middle of Europe, and the heat dome effect in northern Canada. I think these things potentially will happen at increasing intervals, and will have increasingly realization that we've got to move quickly. So the political will I can only see growing to have rapid change, and you can feel it and see it in this year's COP. I was at Heathrow Airport changing planes, and all of the adverts, BBC was running, and it was running a wall-to-wall coverage of COP. There was all these adverts, and they were all based around climate change, whether it was JLL, a buildings company, talking about eco-sustainable building materials, to INEOS, the chemical company, and the company that was previously trying to drive fracking in the UK, talking about hydrogen, INEOS hydrogen. They've just barely launched it. Now they're carpet bombing the whole of Heathrow with their advertising too. Pension funds advertising the ESG characteristics of their funds. And I think, ESG is now becoming a third of global capital markets. And so it'll soon flip, on that part of the curve, it'll soon flip to, it'll be difficult to find non-ESG funds. A huge, huge change in the air. And I think the 1890s, I believe, or the early 19th century was another period of extreme innovation where you had, automotive, telephony, and electricity all hitting all at the same time. So this time, we potentially have got, robotics, AI, clean energy, and other technologies. Genomics is another one, which is, set to have a dramatic impact over the next sort of 10, 20 years in terms of individualized medicine. So, but some of those platforms feed off each other, specifically robotics, AI, clean energy. We'll be able to deploy energy very, very quickly. We're already seeing deployments of of solar, etc., ever speeding up with automated drones, aerial surveying, and all the I can't remember what NL innovated in Mexico, but they were able to build out a field of solar in the Villanueva project, which was 880 megawatt project, so about half the size of Manhattan Island, and they had it done in like 18 months or something. It was record speed in terms of deployments. I think the big issue is going to be grids. I don't know what or how, and particularly on the financing, and that's going to be a massive bottleneck, I think. Opens up a potential opportunity for hydrogen as well, because I think, there's just going to be massive issues. If you think, looking at the UK, I can imagine there's going to be a huge rebound, or there is happening a huge rebound in electric vehicle uptake because of the petrol shortage. And if you start having people buying consumer goods, cars, and they start having, major inflection curves. If you look at the patterns of iPhone, acquisition in sort of 2007 to 2009, suddenly one person gets it, everyone wants it. Grids are used to planning out, 2 years in advance of building a new industrial park, and it needs to be connected. And what happens if a whole neighborhood suddenly goes electric cars for a distribution network? I think that's a similar analogy was back in the days in Chile when we used to work in Chile, and we had all these projects all connected up in the north in the Atacama. But yeah, the grid connection took 4 years, and the renewables projects takes 2 years. So there's a huge bottleneck there. And I can see that reoccurring throughout the world as we start to decarbonize at pace.
A few things I'd like to pick up on there, Nadeem. Obviously, Scotland had something similar with all the wind farms connecting, and they solved it with a kind of queuing system and quite a smart way of doing it. And I suppose you could argue there are actually two grids, the gas grid and the electricity grid. You might actually argue that they might be coalescing more in the future if you put some gigawatt scale electrolyzers at certain pinch points, perhaps near ports and so forth. But just thinking back to the bigger picture again, and this is clearly the bigger picture, to where we were in 2007, where it was boutique, renewables were a niche. From what you're saying at Heathrow, it's mainstream now. It's surprising when a car advert isn't about an electric car or some new innovative thing. Possibly also a little bit about the cost points as well. I mean, I looked at projects in 2007 and the economics just didn't stack up. You were subsidies here and support there, and they just didn't. But now a few things, maybe in a post-COVID environment, people are less cautious about a bit of spend for recovery. And then the cost of the kit, the electrolyzers, the wind farms, the cost of electricity. You mentioned the cost of electricity in the Middle East. It's so cheap, the feedstock, solar energy, that you can get mega projects away because the feedstock is so cheap. And that gives you export potential and all of that. So would you say it's with the city on board and the politicians on board, it's the perfect time now to drive a quantum leap forward that would have been beyond our wildest dreams only 15 years ago. Would you agree with that? It's such a remarkable speed of change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other impact of COVID has been on economics and I think if you look back through history and any jumping from any energy transition where you're jumping from one S curve to another, requires governments and government deployment capital. And then once you're in that next S curve, the government's public money can withdraw slowly as the market begins to shake out and you understand the rules of the game, and then more private operators can actually play and take it up to its sort of maximum. But I think certainly early stage S curves for energy transitions is always been an involvement of big government. So now I think where we've seen clearly what's happening in the Middle East, where you already have always had big participation of public governments in their economies, they are obviously clearly seeing writing on the wall, and they are going to help the transition of their economies into hydrogen as soon as possible. So that will create scale, and they will also create, scale within the end use applications as well, because they want to try and retain as much value as possible in terms of the energy value chain, as it were. So they can export hydrogen, but it's better for them to climb up the value chain and try and house more. Industries in situ to use hydrogen in its various forms. So the classic example is, say, Morocco, who currently have big nitrate deposits and export nitrates, etc. But they want to become the leading, green fertilizer producer. So it's beyond creating green ammonium. It's the next stage further. So that's clearly on the minds of lots of governments, and we've seen where energy is cheap, people have located, data centers and I think aluminium smelting up in Iceland, if I'm not mistaken, because of the historic cheap geothermal energy. So I think that's certainly playing out, and I think there is certainly a much sort of different attitude around governments and deployment of capital that's scaled by governments to try and ensure that they have sizable industries in the future. So that's certainly the
I suppose A lot of countries want to seize the opportunity and also want to be world leaders. So I suppose one risk is if you delay, then somebody else is going to perhaps take the prize, because what you talked about, the cost of doing nothing, certainly perhaps they think on insurance terms and so forth from a climate perspective, but also doing nothing from a country perspective. Obviously, we've got a hydrogen strategy just produced in August in the UK, but everybody seems to be coming out with these strategies. And if you don't seem to have one, then effectively going backwards in industrial terms. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it certainly seems that way. There is a, you know, we're seeing ever increasing interest from governments to attract the hydrogen industry to their locations to show that they have the resources and they want to have a piece of this hydrogen industry. You clearly want to, you know, either be, involved in consuming it or producing it, or even transiting it. You know, if, interestingly, we were looking at Italy recently, where you could have, you know, pipelines coming across from North Africa, and clearly Snam, who own the gas infrastructure in Italy, have a huge vested interest in that infrastructure not becoming a stranded asset, and therefore helping to supply the heartland, the industrial heartlands of Europe, as in the Rhine Valley or Ruhr Valley up in Germany, and transiting hydrogen up northwards. Everyone's got interests, and the geopolitics of hydrogen are interesting. Certainly, and I think we obviously have a course on World Hydrogen Leaders, the geopolitics of energy, through Mika Merritt, who we both know and had dinner with. And it's a fascinating area, the geopolitics. If you start to think about, obviously, what's happening with current gas prices and the role of Russia in European energy mix, but equally potential issues in the Middle East as well with the energy transition and the impacts there. It's going to be an interesting decade, put it mildly.
Okay, well, there's a lot in there. We've discussed an awful lot, Nadeem, today. The Chinwag listenership is not vast, but it is extremely well informed. And if you were to sum up and try and convey the things that are in your mind about being at the heart of this energy transition, what kind of things would emerge? Would there be the scale in the innovation and the geopolitics, or would other nuances emerge in your message to them?
I think the opportunities for change. I think innovation sits at the heart of it, and I think there will be big opportunities, but there will also be big losers as well. The gas infrastructure industry has no right to survive the same as any industry. They obviously clearly want to reuse the gas infrastructure. They want houses to keep using gas. Technology will always win, and innovation will always win. There'll be clear advantages and disadvantages through using alternative sources and ever increasing efficient heat pumps, etc. But equally, where you've got embedded district heating systems, you've got potentially much colder regions, there'll be usage case examples where you will have different technologies being applied. So, and I think there is huge scope and opportunities for innovation. I think that's what I think is going to be interesting, the sheer sort of scale of different sort of opportunities that are opened up. There is this whole process of, I guess, creative destruction, for want of a better word, which I think is always very, very interesting. So yeah, it's certainly what we'll be tracking.
Yeah, I mean, you did refer to a couple of unexpected perhaps consequences. I know in wind, offshore wind has been so successful, it's actually cannibalized other forms of renewables that have found it difficult to compete. against it. I think tidal might be an example of that, as wind, offshore wind costs have plummeted in recent years. Other equally valid technologies of they want to expand and they want to grow and have supply chains. So I suppose there would be a few nuances like that coming forward. But if I was to start wrapping up now, Nadeem, you've shared a lot of thoughts with us. But obviously from where we were 15 years ago, which seems like a lifetime ago, but in historical terms, it's a very, very, very short time. And I suppose, would it be fair to say that you're as optimistic as you've ever been about the green agenda, or do you think, well, we're too late, the time is running out anyway, and 2050 is soon going to be here?
I'm optimistic that we can address a lot of the impacts that are, I'm optimistic that we can try and minimize the impacts that are coming down the track, but I'm also pessimistic about the amount of inbuilt climate change that is coming down the tracks.
Yeah. Okay, are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our Chinwag listeners before we...
Hydrogen Leaders is planning its sort of 2022 portfolio, so we're launching new courses online for the community. The community is now coming up past 900 people, so they're all on there networking and enjoying the content that we produce. And we'll be sort of live out in the markets all throughout 2022. And as I said, we're going to have some meetings now in Dubai and help the associations there. And we'll be in Houston in March. We'll be in Germany with the World Electrolyzer Congress in February. So there's a lot of opportunities to meet, both physically and online. So we'll be there and hopefully providing good content and trying to provide as much honest reporting and stuff on the viability of hydrogen and the usage cases as we go forward. So yeah,
thank you. And I did hear that you needed a bigger venue for the Congress next year. Is that the case, that although Amsterdam was rammed, actually you need a bigger location? Yeah. for next year.
Yeah, we'll be in Rotterdam and we're working on the plan, and certainly it's really much around the content. So we've got sort of a team of five of us now working on the agenda. We intend to produce a fantastic agenda, because there's just so much areas to cover within hydrogen, from obviously from the production, but through midstream to downstream usage case scenarios. So yeah, it's going to be an epic event. So yeah, hopefully it'll be good.
Well, Nadeem Chowdhury, on behalf of John and I, we'd like to thank you. Perhaps you'd rejoin us at some future stage to share further thoughts on the world, the energy transition that we are in the midst of. So on behalf of John and I, to Nadeem Chowdhury, thank you very much indeed for taking part in this Chinwag podcast. Thank you, Nadeem.
Hey, thanks, Charlie. Hey, thanks, John. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Nadeem. I'll just let that run. But what an interesting discussion that was, really. I think some really remarkable things that we're in the midst of. And sometimes when you're rid of the daily grind, you don't see the remarkable. I never thought I would see some of the things. It's beyond my wildest dreams that I thought I'd see Boris Johnson stand up and proclaim for some of the things I've been banging the drum.
He quoted the Enactor electrolyzer and said it was a microwave. Oh,
well, yeah, right. Hey, didn't one of them win Prince William's Prize as well? Wow.
Kaya Cohen's business, but it was there apparently on the sidelines. There's a link, actually. I think I commented on it on the founder of Enactor, whose name is Julius. I'll send it to you. But yeah, it's a Sky report of Johnson talking about it, and he's saying, it looks like a microwave and stuff. It's hilarious.
Well,
I was like, this is not happening. I was talking to Matthias last year and interviewing her.
Who would have thought? So it's great to be at the same. But thanks so much. I know we had a few technical gremlins, which we overcome. I'm a project developer. Yeah. My job is to overcome things. Yeah. Actually, I'm in Glasgow next week, and I've got all these MiFi adapters just in case the Wi-Fi goes down. Who knows what happens? But what I do know is if you try, you do get there. That's from the... And I can only imagine that some of the emotions going through your kind of head in September and August of this year, as countries kept in and come to, oh God, we've got this big event. What do we do? What do we do? And to tough it out. So what a great thing to do. So thank you so much for that. That was really appreciated. And next step is for me to get this saved, send it on to John. We do some jiggery pokery in the background and we'll get it out in a few days' time. But thanks so much. It's really appreciated, and hope things go well for you. Yeah.
in terms of floating wind, I'm beginning to see that. So I'm not sure in terms of the wind content and having a specific depth on floating wind and hydrogen.
It's set for big ramp up. ScotWind is the next one to watch, and stuff happening in California. Yeah. I did a course
for the French are doing a big tender on floating. And also, I was looking through the Italian lens as well, because we're beginning to build up for an Italian event.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's interest there for floating.
There's loads. It's going to be a big ramp up there. So, that can be as long as you want, really. It's as much material as you want. And it's going to go quantum much, much quicker than the 20 years it took us to get a floating industry. I think that could be within 5 years where and real stuff. It's already starting to happen, to be honest, if you watch the tea leaves, and some really interesting stuff happening in Norway as well. Really interesting out there.
Yeah. Because, it'd be interesting to see how much of it, how much more market they can cover with floating winds and what sort of depths they can begin to do.
Yeah, we've got a continental shelf here in the UK, so we've been a bit lucky, but most places haven't got that. So, and that's most places. So bizarrely, all the stuff that we used to throw into the bin, oh no, we can't develop there, it's too deep, is now being retrieved from the bin. And it's some smart things. You want deep depths, but near population centres, because obviously cabling is a big unheralded cost of these. So if you can get somewhere with deep water and a population, and there are plenty of places on the globe with that, that we discounted for most of my time in wind, and then they're now getting looked at. So watch that space. And there's some really interesting stuff with, of course, hydrogen happening as well, with some Project Dolphin. I don't know if you've come across that. It's certainly one to watch with ambition. It's going straight into a mega project, almost with minimal demonstration. It's really, really bold. So let's see how that one goes.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Charlie.
Nadeem, lovely to speak with you. Thanks so much. I'm not sure what time it is with you, but it looks as though there's daylight behind you, which isn't always the case.
Still daylight, 4:30.
Excellent.
Cheers,
Charlie. Nadeem. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, bye.
Bye.